Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to What's the Inspiration? We are so excited to have you here at the Boston Public Library and the Boston Book Festival. I hope everyone is having an amazing literary day today. My name is Laura. I'm the head of children's services here at the Central Library, and I cannot wait to introduce you all to these amazing authors for teenagers who are going to be having a conversation with us this afternoon. So first we're going to go through and introduce everyone. We'll have some time to chat. There will be some time for audience questions at the end, and I do want to let the young people in the audience know that we will be asking grown-ups to hold off so that if young people have questions that they can start us off. So young people, if your brains are going, be thinking about what you would like to ask. And after we're finished with questions, there will be a signing right outside. So thank you for joining us this afternoon. The authors who are here for us today, starting right next to me, is Molly Booth, who has written two novels that take stories from Shakespeare and twist them around and add in a bunch of the deep feelings that come with being a teenager. She is the co-host of the Party Bard podcast, where two Shakespeare super nerds break down moments from plays, and she directs teen LGBT kids in a Shakespearean acting troupe, which sounds amazing. She was just telling us a little bit about it. Her new novel, Nothing Happened, finds out what would happen if Beatrice and Benedict and the rest of Much Ado About Nothing were teenage camp counselors in rural Maine. Next to her, we have Nova Rensuma, who writes books that sneak up on you and make you shiver. Her number one New York Times bestselling, The Walls Around Us, was a finalist for the Edgar Award. Nova teaches at Vermont College of Fine Arts and is the co-creator of a really exciting new project, Foreshadow, a serial YA anthology. Her new novel, A Room Away from the Wolves, brings the gothic into modern-day New York in a suspenseful story where a teen's attempt to connect to her mother's past leads her to an unsettling boarding house for young women. And finally, we have Anna Maria McLemore, whose books for teens take elements from fairy tales and magical realism and her own Mexican-American heritage and build them into mesmerizing stories. Her work has received a Stonewall Honor. She's been a finalist for the William C. Morris Award and has been longlisted for the National Book Award. Her new novel, Blanca and Roja, twists together the transformation story of Swan Lake with the sisters from Snow White and Rose Red to create a vivid fairy tale all her own. Let's say welcome and thank you. So we are here today to talk a little bit about the inspiration behind some of the books that these folks have written for us. So I would love to go down the line and hear a little bit about some of the inspirations that led to your newest books, either the big things like the stories or even stuff as small as the music you were listening to or food, the snacks that got you through your writing.
Hello. So Nothing Happened is a retelling of Much Ado About Nothing, which is kind of like the OG Shakespeare rom-com of Will They, Won't They. So I really wanted to write it because I'm absolutely in love with the cousin relationship that I turned into a sister relationship in the book, but then also I was coming out as queer while I was writing it, and I really wanted to see myself in one of my favorite Shakespeare plays. So that was a really big part of the inspiration for it.
So A Room Away from the Wolves, I think there are two kind of things that inspired it. One of the things is that when I was a young girl, my mom would tell me stories of the happiest year of her life. It was 1969, she was 19 years old, and she was, you know, running around wild in the streets of Manhattan, and New York City was the best city in the world, and that was the happiest time of her existence. And I grew up on those stories almost like they were fairy tales, and like I imagined, you know, myself one day, you know, going to this city where my mother was so happy and finding happiness there myself. So that, you know, imagined fantastical version of New York and my future was one of the inspirations. And then another inspiration was when I was away at an artist colony in upstate New York working on a totally different manuscript, I found myself compelled to change gears because the house that I was staying in kind of like led me in that direction. It was, there was, you know, creepy furniture, gold velvet furniture in the living room, and a portrait of the colony's founder on the wall who would kind of watch me when I walked around, and like old objects that had been hers before she died. And there was something that happened while I was there that led me to, like an itching at the back of my mind that led me to give up on what I was writing, and that was due to my editor and had to be turned in, and totally switch gears, pull a manuscript, and end up writing this book. So part of the inspiration was conscious, and part of the inspiration kind of snuck up on me.
Hi, everyone. But thank you so much for being here. Sorry about this. Tell me if you can't hear me. I think my earring is moving my mic a little bit. I have my red and white, Snow White and Rose Red earrings on, and of course it's the red one that's messing with everything, which is very appropriate because my Rose Red character is the one who screws things up and enjoys it in this book. So Blanca y Roja is my queer Latinx Snow White and Rose Red meets Swan Lake reimagining. I'd wanted to write a Snow White and Rose Red reimagining for a long time. It was one of my favorite fairy tales growing up. I loved the sister relationship. I think especially I was obsessed with sisters because I have all brothers. I'm not going to tell you how many. You would not believe me. But I couldn't quite get my hands around what the angle was on it, what I could contribute new to this reimagining, until I realized that this was ultimately going to be a story about colorism. It was going to be about colorism in general and specifically within the Latinx community. So I ended up pairing it with elements of Swan Lake because there's that same sort of colorism that's a little bit more overt. It's a little bit more subtle in Snow White and Rose Red. It's there, but it's more overt in Swan Lake, the idea of the innocent, virtuous princess and the deceptive seductress. So I put those together and wanted to write this fairy tale that spoke honestly about colorism. And while I was speaking honestly about colorism, I thought, okay, let's just do it. Let's also talk about queer phobia and transphobia within the Latinx community. Let's talk about ableism within communities. So that was when the story really took off, when I realized that the story needed to have more teeth than the original. Reimagining that I was thinking of. So that's when this story came to life and I got to write my Snow White and Rose Red retellings. I love getting my queer brown hands all over fairy tales. It makes me so happy.
So you all talked in those about kind of the family relationships between women, and I would love to hear a little bit more about how those relationships inspired you, whether it's from actual relationships in your lives or whether just things that you were excited to explore a little bit further. Sisters and mothers and daughters, we're hearing all through this. Okay. Anyone who'd like to can jump
I can start. I can jump in. There are many female relationships explored in my books. I feel like that's just what I'm interested in writing about, and it's the meat that I want to get into. You know, I'm interested in, you know, complicated female friendships, and you know, A Room Away from the Wolves, there's an obsessive relationship where my narrator, Bina, is obsessed and fascinated by her mysterious downstairs neighbor, Monet, almost as if she has affection for her and yet also wants to become her. And there's, you know, a very complicated relationship there. But I think the heart of this novel is really the relationship between mother and daughter. And it's because this boarding house that my narrator, Bina, runs away to is a place where her mother had stayed when she was 19 years old. So now you're getting the echo of, you know, my mother's, you know, best year of her life was when she was 19, and I kind of stole that and imagined it. This mother was staying in this room, this tiny room in this boarding house in Greenwich Village in New York, and it was the happiest summer of her life before everything turned. She was going after her dreams, trying to become an actress, and everything changed after this, after she left, and it was this big question mark for my narrator. And we begin the story after their relationship between mother and daughter has gotten kind of fraught. Her mother has basically chosen her stepdaughters and her new husband over her own daughter and kicked my narrator, Bina, out of the house. And that is, you know, those relationships between girls and their moms when you're a teenager, when you're finding yourself and you're making mistakes and you're disappointing someone that you love and yet you can't articulate it, that is something that I found really fruitful to explore and also really emotional to explore. It's like I was reliving a lot of things as I was writing this book in a really emotional way.
The core of Blanca y Roja is really the sister relationship between Blanca y Roja. What they're willing to do for each other, what they're trying to do to overcome a family curse. In this book, every generation has two daughters, and this bevy of swans deep in the woods always take one back and turn her into a swan. So in a situation where they could really be against each other, they try to unite, they try to fight this together, they try to find ways around it. And it's also about the relationship with their parents. Their parents, I loved writing these parent characters because they are good parents. They try really hard, but they cannot help sort of each backing one of them. You have the mother who's telling Blanca, like, I know my husband does sound tech all the time. He'd be like, "What are you doing? Like, you should know what you're doing wrong." But the mother in this book is telling Blanca, like, the ways in which people think you're weak, the ways in which they think you're soft. That's the strength in you. And the father is telling Roja, like, the ways in which people think that you're the bad one, like, you're strong, like, that's something that's going to go with you throughout your life. So the relationships they have with their parents is huge in this book, but also the idea of found families becomes really big through the course of this novel. Either people who step in as parents. I have a couple who are lesbian grandmothers who sort of parent a couple characters in this book whose parents are, for whatever reason, stepping back from them. So the idea of making your own family, whether you have a family who's there for you and you're extending that family into your found family, or you don't have a family that's there for you in the way that they should be, and you are finding that family, you are choosing that family who accepts you as you are. This is particularly important with these two characters I'm talking about, who are sort of parented by these lesbian grandmothers. They're my Bear Prince equivalent if you're following the Snow White and Rose and Red elements, and the Bear Prince's brother. One of them is, the Bear Prince guy is Barclay Holt. He's a guy who's adjusting to having a disability. And Paige, who's my Bear Prince's brother character, is genderqueer, uses alternating pronouns. And Paige's parents really are trying, but they're not understanding in the way that this grandmother does. So having people who act as parents to you, that's something I love writing about.
With Nothing Happened, so as I said, Much Ado About Nothing is originally like this really big romantic comedy, and the stresses are usually on the two main couples in it, which are originally Benedict and Beatrice and Claudio and Hero. But whenever I see or read Much Ado About Nothing, I'm always struck by the relationships between Beatrice and Hero and Margaret and this like core group of friends they've got going. Especially, there's this line, so if you're not familiar with Much Ado, at one point, Hero, who's the younger cousin, is scandalized on her wedding day, and she's dumped at the altar and, like, totally slandered, and it's horrible. And her older cousin, but in my version, sister, Beatrice says something, like, about Claudio, who slandered her. She says, if I were a man, I would eat his heart in the marketplace, which it usually gets a laugh on stage, but whenever I watch it on stage, I go, yeah. Yeah, that's what you're like. I always feel that really deep in my soul. Yes, I would do that. I have four siblings, and I'm very protective of all of them. And so whenever I go to write stories, I seem to center siblingship somewhere in it, or I center a really big platonic relationship somewhere in there. And that seems really important to me, especially since, I was drenched in internalized misogyny in high school. So I was like, I'm not like other girls kind of a person, which was horrifying. So in college, I really came into my own and met some really amazing queer women and, you know, all this stuff. And I started realizing the value of those relationships. So I really want to stress it in the books that I write now because, yeah.
I love the relationship between Beatrice and Hero. I love that you're going deeper into that. I always like that in Much Ado.
Oh, that's so great. I love it too.
Were there things about the original stories that surprised you as you were writing these new stories that were based on things that you have known for your whole lives?
There's a part in the ending of there are pretty intense parts of Snow White and Rose Red, parts that are more sexually suggestive than I knew when I was younger. But those weren't really the parts that sort of caught me off guard when I reread it. There's this one line at the end in one of, like, the Brothers Grimm most rushed denouements ever that's like, and then Snow White married the prince and Rose Red married the prince's brother. It's just like, that's it. She's never met him. We didn't know there was a brother before this. And I just imagined Rose Red being like, excuse me, you just brought me home to your brother? Like, that's what? So that's part of what I wanted to do, is like give that Bear Prince's brother more of a story and give Rose Red a chance to decide who she actually ends up with. Because that disturbed me. It was something that disturbed me on first reading when I was younger, but I thought there has to be more to it than that. So I start flipping through, like, looking for that story in the Brothers Grimm. But at least to my knowledge, it's not there. So making sure that no character ended up as a footnote, ended up as an afterthought, mm-hmm. was something that was big for me in this book.
Same, actually. One of the reasons I wanted to write a version of Much Ado About Nothing was because there are several characters that the backstory just, like, isn't explained. The villain in Much Ado About Nothing, he literally, his motivation is like, I'm a villain. Which is, like, cool Shakespeare. So I was like, okay, I really want to dig into that. And so I really dug into, like, the brother relationship between these two guys and, like, why this person would have this motivation. I wanted to tie that in with toxic masculinity because I made, in this version, John, who's Don John in the original, has a crush on Claudio, but Claudio is Claudia in my version, and he feels entitled to dating her because he's had a crush on her for a couple summers. And then he comes back and she's dating a woman, and he's like, oh, that's just a phase kind of a thing. So his motivation for taking that relationship down becomes this, like, kind of gross toxic masculinity stuff, which he has to learn from. So I guess that surprised me.
When I was going into writing this book, my intention was to write a haunted house novel, right? And of course I was thinking of what I think is the most terrifying and the best haunted house novel, which is The Haunting of Hill House by Shirley Jackson. And I think it's because you never see the ghost. You never see, like, what's happening. The questions are left for you, and that's what's so frightening. And so I went into this thinking, you know, this is what this book is going to be. And what surprised me is that the hauntings and the creepy things were less important than the heart in there and the mother-daughter relationship, which emerged more and more and more and more until there's this scene at the end that I think is, like, one of the last chapters that I think is the most significant part of the book. And I had no idea that that's where I was going with the book. I really did think it was going to be, you know, ooh, a haunted house, ghosts, and it, you know, what I wanted to say surprised me. What the book ended up being surprised me in a way, and it's not so much about that anymore, which I think happens a lot when we're writing. You know, we think we're going and writing one thing, and then, you know, what the story wants to be and what the characters want reveals itself as we write, and it transforms.
One of the things that really struck me reading all three of your books is I felt these very different senses of claustrophobia in the setting, and very, very different. We have this haunted boarding house, we have this woods that's all around you, and we have this camp in the middle of the woods that's just a whole bunch of teenagers thrown together, and there's a certain claustrophobia in that. And I wondered if you could explore a little bit about where that came from in your books.
I mean, I think when I think of being a teenager and I think of, like, who I was growing up in small towns in upstate New York and desperately wanting to escape my house where a lot of difficult things were happening and all I could think about was different ways I might escape, I think of, it just feels so claustrophobic. And I think that general mood is what, you know, when I go back to writing about the person that I was or just thinking about that, it just carries through with me. And I think maybe that's why there's a bit of a claustrophobic feeling in so many of my books. But maybe in a, I don't know, maybe there's a connection here, but, you know.
No, I think that's true. I really wanted to take Much Ado and put it at summer camp because that play is very claustrophobic. I mean, how do you translate, like, two adults getting married in 3 days to, like, teenagers? They can't,
yeah.
Right? Yeah. So I was like, okay, if I think back to when I was a teenager, what experience felt like that? Like, you're all stuck together and there's no escaping each other's feelings, there's no escaping each other's daily moods. And I was like, oh, summer camp. That was we were all stuck together. So definitely, but it's also that Much Ado is a very community-based play, and I really wanted to write about a tight-knit community. I wanted to write about, like, you could, like, step onto that summer camp and everyone's got a million inside jokes, but you still feel included in them, hopefully. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I agree. Similar sense of, like, we're all stuck together. I have so many feelings. Oh my gosh.
So when I write magical realism, two things come to mind, just quick definition of magical realism. One, it's rooted in community. It's rooted in resisting oppression. And two, magical realism is very much about magic that can't be contained, that's unpredictable, that's always an undercurrent. You never quite know what it's going to do. But in all likelihood, it's going to make you think about things that you don't want to think about. It's going to tell your secrets. It's going to tell the secrets of your community. And the woods in Blanca y Roja ended up being sort of this living entity that did that. The feelings of these characters, their decisions often get reflected in what the woods do. They react, or they act, and the characters have to have to react. It's the sort of unpredictable magic that probably gives a sense of claustrophobia, both because you never know when it's going to pop up, and also because it's going to make you confront things that you perhaps don't want to think about, things that you have tried to bury. So that magic, whether it's trees turning to ice, swans coming out of the woods, boys turning into bears, it's all reflecting something that has gone unaddressed and that needs to be spoken.
Well, we've touched on this a little bit, but I would love to talk a little bit more about the really, really amazing ways that you all were queering the canon in this book. We're bringing diversity into the canon. We're trying to sort of bring the modern world into these stories that might not have had the diversity that you're showing in these stories. I'd love to talk about sort of how you approached that in your books.
I'm like trying to call Nodit here because there's so much queer. I'm like, where do I start? Okay. Give me a minute.
Yeah. All right, I can. I'll take a stab at it. So I love Shakespeare texts more than anything in the whole world, and I think I connected with these old, dead, white, probably bi, but a lot of people think straight guy, from 400 years ago, right? And I connected to them back when I identified as heterosexual and back before I identified as queer in, I think, my sophomore, maybe my freshman year of college, somewhere in there. And I think as I got further into, I study Shakespeare at UMass Boston in the master's program, and as I get further into Shakespeare studies, I saw myself less and less in the scholarship, and I saw myself less and less as being like, these stories aren't yours, and it was a little heartbreaking. So I think when I approach them now, I want to think, like, these stories can be for everyone, especially since the more I know about Shakespeare historically, the more I know he was totally bi. He wrote half of his love sonnets for a man. I mean, a lot of white male cishet scholars do a lot of work to justify that in some way. A lot of brotherly romance papers. Anyway, but it's clearly there. And so I want people to be able to connect with those texts, and I do think they're for everybody. And I think there was originally more diversity, obviously not as much as there should have been, but I think there was more diversity in them than we are originally thinking. So I'd like to bring that out.
Well, Blanca, the Snow White character, and sort of the white swan equivalent in Blanca y Roja, is sort of the perfect Mexican daughter. She's obedient, she's quiet, she knows how to cook, which Roja tries to do with hilarious result in this book. So she's everything that she has been told she's supposed to be, with this tiny little detail that she's real gay. So this part of what I wanted to do in this book is to have the character who is held up in these stories so much as the ideal be queer. That was something I wanted to show, is like, being queer is not necessarily something that's transgressive, but something that if you're Latinx, you do need to grapple with how your community is going to receive it. It's something I did and that I'm still doing. And the character that she falls in love with, she has no interest in the Bear Prince character equivalent in this book. She falls in love with a character who's the equivalent of the Bear Prince's brother, Paige Ashby, who's the character I was talking about, who's non-binary, uses alternating pronouns. And I wanted to make Paige, this Bear Prince's brother character, who's kind of a side note in the fairy tale, I wanted to make Paige a heartthrob. Like, Paige knows how to flirt. And that's something I like doing too, because too often trans characters, non-binary characters, and queer characters in general get their hearts broken when they are represented. That happens too much. It is changing, but it's changing slowly, and I hope we see more of it. And it's a reason I like writing queer characters, trans characters, non-binary characters who get the girl. I mean, my husband did.
So. I think for me, there's this subtle layer to Bina's obsession and love for her downstairs neighbor Monet that I think comes through and is complicated in how Monet is connected to her mother and, you know, how who her mother was years ago, but also was absolutely there in the writing of the book. And I don't know if all the readers see it, but I absolutely see it, and I see it at the end of the book, and it was something that I was consciously thinking of and you know, giving to a certain reader at the end.
I would really love to dig into a little bit of the language that you all used, and particularly how writing from these sort of very traditional stories, how that might have changed your language, how that made you approach the language of your books in different ways.
I can go. So writing from a Shakespeare, so my first book, Saving Hamlet, is about teenagers putting on a Shakespeare play. So it's a little inspired by Hamlet, and Hamlet's themes are woven in there, but it wasn't the same thing. This is like really trying to adapt a story. And my first draft of it, I got a lot of notes from my editor that was like, Molly, this is good, but like you can't do it word for word. And it was like I did the exact same scene and act numbers for the whole thing. I was like, it's a straight up retelling. And I really wanted to keep it like that because I want this book to be able to be used in high schools and stuff to like comparatively teach Much Ado About Nothing as an option. And so the best thing my editor did was basically be like, you need to get away from that and you need to stop and you need to stop making awkward conversations happen in this book so that it's like the original language. So if you love Much Ado About Nothing, there are callbacks to the original lines in this book, but they ended up sneaking their way into like internal dialogue, into like funny inside joke references and things like that. And so it became less like, okay, the dialogue isn't a one-to-one translation. I have to figure out how this play really works as fiction more than just a play adaptation.
You know, it's funny, like thinking of the language and again thinking of what a book is at the beginning when we first think of it and how it transforms and how we see how it plays in you know, when other people read it as opposed to when it's just in our heads. I mean, when I was, because the original inspiration was this classic haunted house tale, right? And also there was some inspiration from, you know, the Breakfast at Tiffany's, which is, you know, this male unnamed narrator who is basically obsessed with and watching his downstairs neighbor, and her life is so much more exciting than his. And so there was some of that. And so when I wrote the first draft, when I was writing like the opening chapters, I had this like old-timey like narration going on that I thought was just like, you know, I don't know. I thought it was working better than it was, and then my my partner who read it was just he's just like, do you realize like how boring and stodgy this seems? Like are you wanting to communicate that to your readers? And I like he can be very blunt. So I couldn't see it because I just had this vision of what something, you know, sounded like in my head. And as I was writing through it, I again felt like the character came through in a way that changed the language and changed the way the book was being told. Also, you know, when there were more playing with memory and more sense of playing with time, things kind of shifted in the way I was telling it, and the way that the lines came out and the way I started writing it meant that I basically had to rewrite everything that I had done before to find, you know, to find the true voice and to find what the heart of the story was. I mean, it went through 7 drafts with my editor and more before she saw it, and it was just one of those organic discovery kind of novels.
That is a strong relationship you have with your partner. My husband has bowed out of reading my first drafts because he's just been like, I'm not going to be the one to tell you this. He always reads it fairly early on in the process, especially because I do write trans characters, non-binary characters, and those are his identities. He's always very gracious to help me with that. But yeah, he won't read the first draft because he doesn't want to tell me things like that. So I'm very impressed by your relationship.
Well, you should know that we also fight about it and I get very upset. So maybe that helps. Maybe
not. Yeah, that might be why we don't do it.
I'm very sensitive. Yeah.
So with Blanca y Roja, because you have these fairy tale elements, I was going for narration and a feel that had a little bit of a timeless feel, but that was also modern. So it sort of ended up being a middle ground because this is so soaked in the sort of fairy tale mythology, but also you have a contemporary sensibility about non-binary and genderqueer identity. So it's sort of a mix there. I'm using some slang words that my cousins and I use now. So it's that intertwining of like fairy tales that have been around for a very long time and right now. And that's often what happens with magical realism. Magical realism is often set in the time period that the writer is in. But there's this calling back of what has been of your community's history, not just, and that's here too, not just the fairy tales, but what is the legacy that your parents, your grandparents have left you?
Nelva, you mentioned that sort of the voice of your character really inspired where this went, and I'm really interested to hear about the perspectives for Molly and Anna Marie, because you both had multiple perspective characters, sometimes really short chapters, and that particularly Molly's like would jump for a couple paragraphs and go back and forth. I'd love to hear about why you made those choices about how your perspectives would work in these stories.
I think part of it was what I mentioned earlier, that I didn't want any of these four characters to be an afterthought. I wanted them all to have their own voices, because they all had their own stories. They all had to be able to speak for themselves at some point. Blanca y Roja, their characters came pretty quickly. I could hear their voices in my head. I could hear how they were different, even though they had some of the same resonance with each other. Paige came next. I started hearing Paige's voice. The one I had the most trouble with was Barkley, whose chapter headings are titled Yearling for a reason you'll read in the book. I had the hardest time with him. I don't think I've ever written a white straight cis guy before, and it's kind of funny that I struggled most with this. But like a couple of my critique partners, they basically said like this looks like your parody of what you think guys think like, because it was just so stripped down of feelings. And then my husband looked at it and he was like, yeah, we do have feelings. So just accessing, and this again goes back to these living, breathing, reacting woods that sort of reflect your feelings back, like digging into that and making sure that I was showing as much of his inner life as I was of the other characters, and showing you enough so that you can guess what he can't guess about himself, what he's not registering about his own emotional life.
Totally. It's very similar. I wanted to write multiple perspectives because I wanted to explore the characters that only got a couple lines or didn't get very much backstory. Mine has, I think, six different perspectives. The first time I turned that in, my editor was also like, Molly, no. But it was fine. I felt really strongly that the community should be fully represented. I really felt to get that good feeling of claustrophobia that I'm glad you got, because I was going for it. I really thought we needed to feel the camp kind of from all different sides. And not only that, feel in Much Ado About Nothing, there's a lot of power dynamics going on in terms of who's most important. So a lot of the kids in Nothing Happened, they're in this group that are like clearly the popular kids at summer camp. Like, they all have a really tight knit, and I love them, but they're also kind of jerks to the people who are like one tier lower on the popular scale, right? So it was really important to me to get like a full picture of what was going on at camp, not just like this is a magical teen group that's all really great. It's like they're excluding people too, and I think those are really big problems at summer camp, so I really wanted to explore that. In terms of the actual writing of the characters, I've never written more than one perspective before. I've only done one book, and it was all perspective from one person. And what I found was, like, I had to make like these really deliberate choices. With the first book, it all came organically, and it was all out of Emma's voice. I didn't really have to think about what she sounded like versus other people. But with this one, I had to like make choices about vocabulary, like whose vocabulary looked like what, and all these different things that I hadn't had to grapple with before. And the hardest character to write was Claudia. She is the character that in the original play is Claudio, and she ended up being my favorite to write, but it took a long time to find her voice, and I literally think it's just because she's kind of shy. like we had to like hang out a little bit before I could really hear what she was saying. But she's just very reserved. She's got so many feelings. She's like this storm of feelings trying to keep all of them inside, and so I had to like figure that out about her, but now I love her very much.
So this book is first person, one character, and I actually intended it to have this other voice, a third person voice that was almost an omniscient, like almost as if the city was telling part of the story. And so the original opening was written with this voice, and there were these interspersed little pieces, which kind of like felt useful at first because I really liked them. And then as the writing of the novel came on, it was like it was totally forced. You could tell it was just like the writer really wants to try writing in third person omniscient. She's going to stick another chapter in. And my editor was very honest with me about like what was needed for this story and what would make the story feel fully complete. I ended up removing those pieces and rewriting some of them in first person. But there's this part of me, and I think it's because I've never published a novel written in third person omniscient that's like, I'm not done with this. Like, I think, you know, having multiple perspectives in a different kind of, you know, a different kind of voice would be a challenge that I want to try. But there was something about this book, and I think because, again, I was finding its story and I was finding its heart that needed to be more internal. But if you're ever curious about what the pieces would have sounded like, there was a cut chapter that was published on Tor.com last month, and it's from the perspective of the portrait on the wall that's watching all the girls in the house. And that was one of the weird omniscient pieces that doesn't have a place in the book anymore, but I still really liked, so it's now out in the world somewhere.
No, so I, cool. And I love hearing about how kind of these mythical settings that I think all of you were exploring a little bit really came into the books. I'd love to hear, particularly the woods that we have happening, very different woods. I'd love to hear about how kind of you, whether there are some of those mythical settings, woods that you have loved in literature that might have inspired you, or what led you to these kind of these mythical places, this mythical New York that you really were exploring too, Nova.
I mean, for me, when I'm working on my ideas, the first thing that comes to me is place. I'm a writer who explores characters so much, so you would think that the characters would come first, but the place always comes first for me, and then the characters emerge either from that place or somehow connection to that place. So for me, of course, it was this mythic version of New York, but it was also this house that was inspired by the house that I had been staying in when I was writing, and something about wanting to maybe give answers to mysteries that I didn't know when I was there allowed me to, you know, follow it and explore it in my novel. I'm just curious, does place come first for either of you when you're writing, or is it characters? Is it characters? Is it place?
What is it? Sometimes, it's often the magical elements first, and then probably the characters, and then this. I think
so. Not the woods.
I know, but now that I think this might be begging the question because my writing process is not organized yet. One day it will be an organized process. But I think I've always been enchanted by this idea of like the fairy tale woods, especially like, growing up in LA. It's a lot of desert. We have some nice national forests. Unfortunately, they do not look as good as they used to, thanks to the drought. But this like mythos of the enchant. Am I saying mythos? Is that how you say that word? This is what happens from like reading and not saying these words out loud until I'm on a panel. but that idea of that enchanted wood that so many fairy tales are taking place in, and that you sometimes almost think of different fairy tales happening at the same time in. And also being married to who I'm married to, like this guy loves getting lost in forests in a way that I do not understand. Like he loves going off trail wherever it's permitted. He loves trees. He loves exploring forests. So whenever we're in woods, it's like we're two different fairy tale characters where he's like, isn't it beautiful, this species of trees? And I'm like, we're going to get eaten by a bear out here. So I'm the one who wants to go back and he's the one who wants to keep going. So learning that from someone that I'm close to, someone that I'm with in woods a lot whenever we can, and also having in the back of my mind like the fairy tale wood TM that so many fairy tales are sort of thought of to happen in, and I'm really interested to hear about, because yours are going to be really different than hopefully like trees aren't turning to ice or bleeding.
No, not so much. Although that would be kind of cool. That would be a different kind of Much Ado About Nothing. You should write that. That would be great. I'd be really into that. Mine is not magical realism at all. So it's contemporary and set in modern day. But when I think about summer camp and I think about these sets of teens at this summer camp is this place that they go to escape. And this place where they have like a support network where they can kind of be themselves more than they feel like they can be at school during the year. This is kind of the summer where it all catches up to them, where they've like very much okay, this is my camp self and this is my school self. And this summer, there's a couple things change for these characters that those lines start to blur and they realize they can't really leave behind how they feel during the year. So I kind of thought of the woods here, I guess, that there's a lot of woods. I mean, most of this is inspired by Girl Scout camp because, like, heck yeah. but definitely it was, I was kind of thinking as, like, the pastoral as queer, and, like, you could, like, escape here and be your queer self in these woods, or you could escape here and you would have to deal with who you were in these woods a little bit. Yeah.
So we just have 1 minute left before we go to questions, so I would just love to hear what any of you would recommend to a reader who has loved your book to read next.
If you haven't read The Astonishing Color of After by Emily XR Pan, I hope you all go out right now and buy it.
If you're this is a contemporary book, but if you're looking for queerness that's handled in a very sensitive, beautiful way, also while talking about being of color and being queer and coming out to your family and family relationships in general, please read Picture Us in the Light by Kelly Lloyd Gilbert. It's her second book that came out this spring, and it is absolutely stunning. It's very much about, like, what do we owe each other in a community? What do we owe our family, especially when our family has given up so much for us?
Very cool. Shakespeare, but a little darker, is As I Descended by Robin Talley, which is the queer retelling of Macbeth, where Lady Macbeth and Macbeth are both young women at a boarding school. So I would recommend that.
Thank you all so much. So as I mentioned at the beginning, if any young people in the audience have questions, I would love to see young people's hands first. A microphone will come to you. So if we have any teens or kids who have questions, get your hands up there and a microphone will find you. We'll give it just, and I think somebody does.
So I was wondering what you decided to keep from, in terms of fairy tales, and, like, you were saying that you originally had the, you were kind of just doing a straight retelling of Much Ado About Nothing, and I was wondering, in the end, what did you guys decide, how did you decide what to keep and what to change?
Well, great question, thank you. For me, I think I had to start seeing the characters in their evolved form and more as different people from the original characters, and once that started happening, I started cutting things, saying, okay, this is really the direction the story is moving in, and I really have to go with what these characters are feeling. I also had to think a lot about redemption for the character of Claudia, because I hate Claudio in the original play. He's a horrible human. And so I had to think, okay, what's going to change for him? So I think for her, I had to do a lot more of internal stuff that the original play would have allowed.
I think just in general of, like, deciding what to keep and what to go, I mean, the first draft of this book was almost like 120,000 words. It was really, really long. And then I kept, you know, seeing that it's almost like I was writing toward what I was trying to write, you know, like it took me weeks to get there. I'm like, oh, right, I just want that sentence, you know, after I wrote 50 pages. But there was a point when my editor sat me down and she was like, I see this as a taut, slim ghost story. And she said, slim taut, and I'm like, and then she said, we need to cut, and she gave a number of words. It was like a lot. It was like 40,000 words. It was like a lot of words. And I just remember just like reeling, just like and then I thought of it as a real challenge. And like, what is essential in this story? What do I absolutely need to have? And so I slimmed it down so far and I only had the essential. Then I turn it in and she's like, well, now we need, you know, just more, like, you know, character stuff, and like, why is this happening? And like, so then it expanded from there, but it was a really great lesson in going through and seeing what is essential to my story, what are the things that can go, what are the things I can let go of, even if I love them, like that, the portrait, seeing the girls and you know, in the living room and narrating, like, I loved it. But it wasn't essential to the book. And I think that's a great lesson for all writers, no matter what we're writing. If we're writing something based on something that is already in existence or something in our imagination, maybe the book is too gigantic and unwieldy, and if you slim it down to its barest bones, what's left?
In many ways, Snow White and Rose Red and Swan Lake are both pretty archetypal. They're pretty bare bones. So I had to do a lot of fleshing out of these characters, like you were talking about, especially because I was thinking of what you said about like he's a villain because he's a villain. looking at the antagonistic forces in this book, the people who turn out to be the villains, what do they want? What are they trying to get? And by the way, the woods are not the villain here. As painful as they are to deal with for these characters, the woods are actually trying to help them. So having these characters be fully realized and be characters that are going to come off the page and seem like people you know, rather than the archetypal fairy tale type who are in ways characters we know, but not in the way that you would if you heard them speak more, if you heard a little bit more of their daily life, if you saw them getting their periods, which happens in this book. So especially imagining them now was part of that challenge.
Any other young people with questions today? Okay, we're open to grown-ups.
Hi. So I have a question for Molly about toxic masculinity.
Sure.
Because I love Much Ado so much, and I've actually been rereading it a lot in the past few weeks with everything that's been going on. When I picked up this book, I was happy to see the queering of the canon, but also a little surprised because for me, the character Claudio, who I also despise, is very tied in with that kind of toxic masculinity. And so I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about your decision to make her Claudia in this retelling instead and sort of put a lot of that toxic masculinity on John, which is already there in the original, but really make that the focus.
Yeah. Oh, thank you so much for your question. Yeah, it's Shakespeare doesn't get old. It stays pretty timeless. I think with Claudio and Hero in the original play, I gave myself a challenge in terms of like I really hate this character. This character does some really horrible things, and we don't know why that is. And how do I make that character for me sympathetic and empathetic? How do I make that character somebody I want to explore and write about? And also, if this was set in a modern time, what kinds of things would this character be dealing with if she was queer? And so that character has a really rough backstory with her school. She's got a lot of her friends dropped her because she was queer, and she's trying to fit into this toxic masculinity at camp and hang with her friends, who a lot of whom are dudes, and they're saying some pretty terrible things, and she's trying to keep up with them. So I think I just really wanted to explore that, especially since I couldn't imagine writing a Claudio the way he is, that in a way that I would find sympathetic, in a way that I would want to explore him as a character. That I'm sure lots of other people should do that if they write, but this was my Much Ado About Nothing, so I was like, okay, what do I really want to focus on in this story? So definitely that. And then in terms of toxic masculinity in the book, I think you've got John, who is representing a lot of toxic masculinity, but you also got his friend Bobby, super toxic masculine. I mean, this whole play is just dripping in it. And the original play is very much Battle of the Sexes, right? Like, that's how people identify Much Ado About Nothing. But I was like, that's what feels a little dated for this story, so what am I going to do? So I explore a lot of the ways in which teenage boys talk about sex to each other. I explore a lot of the ways in which we, you know, that kind of a thing going on. And so a lot of that is in kind of the theme of the book as well. And last, I really, with Benedict, he was really hard to write because I was like, okay, in the original play, we've got a lot going on with him, but I do want him to come off well. So I decided, I like set out to write, you know that meme that's like, they're like, oh, so is all masculinity toxic? And you're like, no, some masculinity's fine. Then it's just Mr. Rogers. So I was like, okay, I'm going to write Ben like he's Mr. Rogers. And so I really tried to, like, you've got Donald, who's, like, a good guy, but, like, kind of coming at it from a very much more normal space. And you've got Ben, who's kind of a little bit more advanced in his internalized, like, sexism journey. So you've got a lot of that going up head-to-head, I guess. Yeah, sorry. Long answer.
Thank you. Other questions today?
Hi. What do you consider the best thing your editor has ever told you?
So when I was writing this book, I mentioned the 7 drafts. I mentioned all the words that was then slimmed and then expanded and blah, blah, blah. But I was having a really hard time figuring out what this novel wanted to be. And it was, I think it was partly because, you know, I had written a whole draft of something and pulled it and then changed to this book. And I also think it was a bit of just anxiety and pressure over what my previous book was, because it like, there were readers and it did well, and then I was like, how am I going to do this again? You know, and the pressure of it, I was just so blocked, and I was having a really hard time. And I had lunch with my editor. This is when I still lived in New York. I recently ran away. I recently moved away. but I had lunch with my editor, and we sat down at the table, and I remember so vividly, this was maybe like draft 4, and she leaned forward and she asked me a question that broke open everything for me. And the question was, who is the ghost in this novel? Now, if you read the novel, that will make so much more sense to you maybe than that. But that question made me basically question everything about what I thought my book was in a good way. And it challenged me, and it made me see that, oh, I'm not going to just write this draft and make it good enough and turn it in and just have another book come out because this was hard. I'm going to keep working at it no matter how many more drafts it takes, and I'm going to get it to be what it's supposed to be. And it was that conversation that started with that question that really changed everything for me.
I think the best thing my editor has ever told me is you can push back, like on the things that people say, on the critiques that people have about my manuscripts. I greatly value the feedback I get, but at some point something's not going to resonate with you. And if you have multiple people reading your manuscript at the same time, some of what they say is going to conflict. So if you're in the space that I was in, where everybody else is right about my book, even if I'm operating under that assumption, at some point they're going to be arguing with each other because they don't agree. So it took her a while to get this through my head, to say you can push back, you're the one deciding what. And this was a process with my first book. You can decide what's right for your book. And this became really important writing my second book, because for reasons of self-loathing that I won't go into, I thought I wasn't really allowed to write a brown queer book. I didn't think I was allowed to write both those identities at the same time, even though that's what I live, that's what my life is. And we sort of came back to that when she was saying, like, this has to be a book you can stand behind. Mm-hmm. And her telling me that, the sort of resonating thought of her saying you can push back, and in this case, you can push back against what the world has told you about your identities, that let me write the kind of queer Latinx books I wanted to write.
My editor has said a lot of things that I really, really have appreciated. She's very affirming. But I think with Nothing Happened, probably one of the biggest things that was most important is early on in the process when we were trying to figure out Hero, who's a character who's sort of developed in the original play, but not super developed. She's Hannah in this version. I kind of had this idea to take her to a place where I could explore depression with her. Mm-hmm. And my editor was all for that, and she was like, this is the direction we need to go in, and this is the place we need to go. That was kind of scary for me, but I think she does a good job of pushing me when I'm like, oh, maybe I'll do this. It's like, no, you've got to do that. She does a really good job of that. So her making space and allowing me to write that character that way and encouraging me to write that character that way was really integral to the book.
Anyone else with questions today?
So we've been talking a lot about female characters, which is amazing, and sort of like, I know since we've talked about adaptation or, you know, working really in a genre that's been, you know, done a lot and done over the years, how do you create female characters that exist in a world where we have tropiness, where we have, you know, these are the types of women that exist in books largely written by men, and, you know, how do you walk that line between, oh, I'm just going to write a woman who doesn't exist in that world because I'm tired of dealing with it, versus, no, I want to take those tropes and reclaim them. Like, how do you sort of choose that for yourself as an author?
I sort of leaned into them with Blanca y Roja, because especially women get put into these boxes. Like, you are the pure virtuous one. Like, you are the troublemaker. So that's, even if it's something that you end up pushing back against, it's still something you live with. It's still a system you live under, especially as like women of color. Like in my community, I love my community, but that's a big thing. Like Madonna whore. It's the whole like a lot of marionismo, a lot of machismo that feeds into that. So I don't know if I could write a book that doesn't at least in some way acknowledge that, because it's there. It's there in our world, but there's also the opportunity for characters to push back against that, and for the story itself to push back against it.
I think we can respond in so many ways to the world around us and what's going on, and how how people and people of all genders are seen, and women. And For me, it makes me just want to write, you know, the unlikable girl character who makes mistakes, and really, really dig into that and show, why, and show a flawed character, and show a real character that, you know, is authentic and is not, you know, what we're, you know, suddenly she's unlikable, she's not worthy, that she is worthy. And so that's something that I just love reading about personally, and I hope that there's just more and more of that, but also I think it's important, especially for, you know, YA readers to not be judging our girl characters on what they do.
For sure. I like to start with a trope, and then I similarly, like, okay, I know these three things about this character, but what complicates all of those things? Like, how do I make this a real fleshed out person? Because when we think about tropes, like Beatrice in the original play, right? Bossy, that's kind of all she gets. She gets bossy, and they call her all of these terrible names because she's more in her time period, she would be considered like outspoken, kind of shrewish, kind of like that. And so in this version, I kind of make her this character that she is outspoken and all these things, but everyone really admires her in that setting instead, because like she, now it's modern day and she can be in charge of a lot of things and she runs everything. And Ben, instead of in the original play, he's like, ugh, my Lady Disdain, she's just in charge of everything, but he secretly likes her. In this version, Ben like really admires that she runs everything and is just like, yeah, this is such a cool thing about her. So I try to play with that, like what things are going to be different in modern times than they would be in the original thing, and how do I make that fuller?
We have time for one more question. Who wants to bring us on home? I think I see a hand back there.
It's me again. I was kind of wondering, you guys are talking about, you have all these really big sort of concepts in your book, like women and queer, like the LGBT, and I was kind of wondering, like, did you start writing, like me personally, I started writing for myself because I didn't really like where I was, so I made a different space for myself, but do you guys, like, is that how you started, or did you start writing for other people, like, this was my experience, but I want you guys to know that it's okay, or was it kind of a combination of both?
You know, I've always, I think because I started writing as a way to, you know, find ways to communicate and to feel okay in myself and kind of like fix myself when I was very young, when I was a teenager. So really when I begin writing, it's at first for myself, but it's for like the young people like me too, and I know that they're out there, and so it's always so personal. I can't imagine myself writing if it didn't start from a personal place that then I wanted to share, but that the seed of it is personal.
I think I originally started writing fiction to process awkward encounters I'd had with boys. So that's where it started originally, and then I couldn't really write more than 10 pages at a time, and then I had a lot of feelings about that. But I think then when I kind of discovered why it was my favorite genre, and I hadn't really thought that I could write it, and then when I realized that that might be something I actually wanted to do, I realized that that gave me a larger purpose, and that sharing the things that had happened to me and sharing my experiences would serve a larger community and would help, because I had a really tough time as a teenager. So I really, that gave me this big purpose to write for.
I had to learn to write for myself in any discernible way because I talked a little bit about this before. I thought I wasn't allowed to write girls like me. I thought it was some kind of transgressive act to write like brown girls in fairy tales, to write queer Latinx stories. So it wasn't until readers responded, and it was really readers who made me feel like I had permission to do this, to keep doing this. It wasn't until readers responded and said, yes, we want these stories. We want to read stories like this, that I felt like I could follow the ideas I'd had, but that I'd held myself back from. So I think I ended up, I'm writing more for myself now than I did before anyone was looking at my work, because I just had the voice of what I should be writing when I was just hiding my writing. So it's I really owe readers a lot for telling me that what writing stories from my community, that there are places for those stories.
These books are available for purchase right outside, and these wonderful authors are going to be available to sign. Please buy them, please read them, please say thank you, and thank you all for joining us.